Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Tresidder from Somerset, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Dr. Peter Bagshaw, GP, also from Somerset.
And today we're going to talk about a subject, Doctor, I'm short of breath. So, Peter, how are we going to tackle this?
Well, I don't know about you, Andrew. I find when people present with this, it's a really complicated thing to deal with because so many things can underlie it. So we think of respiratory conditions, but of course, cardiac conditions can cause it. Hematological things like anemia can cause it, and so many different things. So I don't think we'll go into the differential diagnosis and the list of things we have in our heads, Andrew. But what I'd really like to tackle is when people should be concerned about it in themselves or people they know, and what action they should take. And then perhaps if we've got time, a little bit of self-care on established conditions. But I think I'd stress that shortness of breath, especially if it's new or a worsening of existing shortness of breath, definitely isn't something for self-care. You really need to see your GP.
Thank you. So if we start out by sort of thinking, okay, some people have been short of breath a bit for quite some time, but let's say I'm short of breath today and it's happened today. Doctor, I'm really short of breath today and this is new for me. How are you going to tackle that?
Well, I would be very concerned. If it's a new onset, just days, and it's severe, then I would be thinking quite serious things. And so would you, Andrew. I mean, particularly we'd be thinking about pulmonary embolus, pneumothorax, maybe even a heart attack, which doesn't always give pain, and possibly pulmonary embolism due to a deep vein thrombosis. So what other things will be going through your mind, Andrew? That's a pretty long and scary list, isn't it?
I think so. Anaphylaxis would be one, but if you're short of breath of the instant, perhaps something could be stuck, whether it's a peanut or a bit of meat or something, because that'll make you short of breath, not for a day or so, but for now, this very moment.
Yes, absolutely. And it can be something sort of fairly benign, like if you've suddenly developed a chest pain that isn't due to a heart attack, but is musculoskeletal. But I think anyone with sudden onset shortness of breath should be seen, investigated, treated urgently to rule out the potentially serious and in some cases, even life-threatening conditions. If you had somebody on the phone to you, Andrew, in your surgery, would you say, right, I shall see you in surgery this evening? Would you say, make an appointment tomorrow? Or would you say dial 999?
Really good question, Peter. I'd probably take a little bit more history before deciding this is somebody with acute shortness of breath. I'd certainly want them seen that day. Whether it would be me seeing them or whether they need more urgent hospital care would depend a little bit on the questions, on the answers to the questions that I asked. So, Peter, what would you guide you to suggesting that somebody goes straight to hospital?
I think certainly if they had chest pain associated with their shortness of breath, that would concern me because that would suggest it might be cardiac. And with that, really, the first 30 minutes are critical, aren't they, in terms of improving outlook. So I would ask, for instance, have you got a fever? Are you coughing up anything? Are you coughing up blood? Is that the sort of thing you've got in mind, Andrew?
Absolutely. Let's just concentrate on the chest pain, because as you said earlier, you could have sort of cricked your back and it'd be painful when you're breathing. But what sort of nature of chest pain guides us towards cardiac?
Yes. So with cardiac pain, it tends to be central. People often describe it as crushing, like a heavy weight sitting on the center of your chest, don't they? So that central crushing chest pain, and often feeling a bit sweaty, a bit lightheaded. Sometimes the chest pain goes to the left shoulder or down the left arm, sometimes up into the jaw. Exertion tends to make it worse. And it's a pretty sudden onset, and you generally feel pretty unwell, though not always, of course.
And that's quite possibly a heart attack, or that ought to be excluded. So you mentioned pulmonary embolism. So that's where major arteries are blocked. What sort of pain would you get with that? And what sort of symptoms do you get with that?
Well, completely different, isn't it, Andrew? And so with that, it's often called a pleuritic pain. So the idea is that you've got inflammation on the surface of the lungs, and as you breathe, it rubs, and that causes pain. So that's a sharp, stabbing pain, usually made worse when you breathe, and it's on the periphery, it's on the outside of the chest rather than in the center. And of course, the muscular pain that you describe can mimic that. And some people will get a pulmonary embolus without that pain. So it's not quite straightforward. But in general, that sharp stabbing pain that's worse when you breathe in is a severe clue. And then you would want to check to see, well, are they at risk of a clot? Have they had major surgery recently? Have they flown? Have they got any signs of a swollen leg? That sort of thing. So a DVT, a deep vein thrombosis, is usually what precedes pulmonary embolus.
Thank you, Peter. You mentioned flying, but actually, some people sit in their cars for a very long time. And can, you know, if you drive from the south to Scotland, it could be several hours in a car. And for somebody who's susceptible, and especially if you fluid restrict and other issues, that may cause it.
Absolutely. And bed rest. So when I was in hospital with sepsis earlier, they gave me daily Clexane to thin the blood and stop clotting happening. For precisely that reason. Yeah, absolutely right, Dave, Andrew.
So if there's shortness of breath and there's chest pain or shortness of breath, does faintness, if people feel a little bit faint, is that relevant? Is that important?
Yes, I mean, that suggests that it's dropping your blood pressure. So again, that would push you towards more of a cardiac sort of scenario, wouldn't it? And I think we have to say that if you suspect a heart attack, you don't come to see the GP. The important thing is getting a paramedics with a defibrillator to you as soon as possible. So just dialing 999 is absolutely the way to go if the story suggests a heart attack.
Yes, and a massive pulmonary embolus could also do it, as well as a cardiac problem sitting across the saddle of the pulmonary arteries.
Yes, I think myocardial infarction, heart attack, is about a 1 in 5 risk of death. And pulmonary embolus is about a 1 in 10 risk of death, isn't it?
Right, yes. Let's just think about foreign body. If you inhale something, I mean, we all have a good cough reflex, we hope, but small children can inhale a peanut or something which could cause them problems. Adults might inhale you're chewing on a piece of meat and then suddenly it goes down the wrong way. And that's pretty time critical to deal with that at this instantly, really.
Yes, absolutely. And again, generally the history will be clear, but sometimes with young children, it's not obvious, is it? And I think it might be worth just digressing that we would deal with shortness of breath in children in a slightly different way. So you're generally not thinking of cardiac causes. You're thinking of respiratory causes. We were discussing with our producer, David, about his son having had shortness of breath from a viral infection recently. So you would be thinking along different lines, I think, with children, wouldn't you?
You would.
And they have smaller airways, so they get shortness of breath more easily. Yeah.
So thinking of an adult who's been chewing something and something has got stuck and there's a degree of respiratory obstruction. What's that manoeuvre that people should know about?
The Heimlich manoeuvre.
The Heimlich manoeuvre.
Yes.
And so if we see somebody and we suspect that their breathing is obstructed, they're sort of making efforts to breathe, but it doesn't look like anything's going in and out, and they're maybe pointing to their throats and saying they're choking. What should someone do?
So you can do back slabs, slaps as an initial thing, and sometimes that will dislodge it. And then if that fails, you do the Heimlich maneuver, which is where you go behind somebody, you bring your hands round to the front, join your hands and pull in sharply under the sternum. Is it something you've ever done, Andrew? I've been taught it, but I've never had to use it in anger.
No, I haven't ever done it myself. So we're putting our arms around the person's chest or around their abdomen? It's around their abdomen. And then
around your abdomen. Yes, absolutely. Because around the chest, obviously the rib cage will stop you pulling in. If you do it in the abdomen, that can increase the pressure enough to eject the foreign body. And yeah. I don't know if it's an urban myth or whether it actually is reality, but I did read that Dr. Heimlich was in a nursing home and choked on food, and actually one of the residents there had learnt his manoeuvre and saved his life through his own manoeuvre. But really? That may just be an urban myth. I'm sure people out there will know.
I haven't done it myself, but I was at a celebration a couple of years ago where somebody had it done to them, unbeknownst to me, on another table, because they were obstructing, having chewed something. Heimlich manoeuvre always reminds me of what was that film, Mrs. Doubtfire? Robin Williams, and I think part of his... Part of his CV was that he'd been trained in the Heimlich manoeuvre when he was going for the job looking after his own children.
Absolutely. Yes, the late, great Robin Williams. So those are acute things. And I think, you know, we need to take that seriously. But there'll be other things where people say, oh, I've become short of breath in the last couple of days, where we don't need to dial 999. We can deal with it. Still fairly acutely, but in a slightly more relaxed way. Do you want to run through some of those, Andrew?
That would be very helpful. Should we start with respiratory? And I think many of us would think of shortness of breath, asthma, as one thing coming up. Because there are, well, let's just divide it up. So there are respiratory causes, that's lungs and chest. There are cardiac causes. There are
hematological.
So
somebody with severe anemia will be short of breath. I mean, normally if it's acute blood loss, you'll have a lot of other symptoms like low blood pressure, but if it happens gradually, it can sometimes be the only symptom in somebody who's got their anemia.
Yeah,
but it will tend to be a much longer onset.
Yes, and there are probably others as well. So which area would you like to think about first?
I mean, the majority of people will see with shortness of breath, it's probably going to be either, again, thinking acutely. So not thinking of things like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which we'll probably come on to later. But in most cases, it'll be an infection of some sort, won't it? An upper respiratory tract infection. And that can be quite tricky to diagnose. Again, in children, it's often difficult because the airways are smaller, so they become wheezy and short of breath more quickly, and it's not always asthma. So if you see somebody with that sort of story, how would you tell between a viral infection that is self-limiting, a bacterial infection that needs antibiotics, or maybe asthma that needs longer-term treatment? It can be tricky, can't it?
It can be very tricky indeed. There's been some new guidance coming out on this, in that it looks very much as though we should be rarely using antibiotics in children, that actually infections that are bacterial are really quite uncommon. And that's not quite so true for adults, particularly the elderly, although generally I think viral infections are much more common without bacterial complications than we would. Let me put this slightly differently: that the viral infections are common. Sometimes there are bacterial complications. Bacterial infections are around, but are probably less common than are thought to be.
Yes, I've read figures of about 20% bacterial, and maybe that's an overestimate. And I mean, I think I probably deluded myself that I was quite good at picking those up, because typically people have a higher fever, they're more unwell. Often you hear crackles, what we call crepitations in the chest, or sometimes even consolidation, where you can't hear any breath sounds because the lung has gone solid. And green phlegm is often taken as being a sign of a bacterial infection. But sadly, none of these clinical signs and symptoms are absolutely clear-cut, are they, Andrew, which always makes medicine more challenging.
Absolutely. Certainly you can get quite a lot of green phlegm in asthma with no infection. And you can get a fever in asthma, but a prolonged fever and swinging fevers, prolonged high fever of 38 or more, would certainly point us towards a bacterial infection.
And sadly, I'm becoming a bit of a case study in quite a lot of things these days. So when I have my own pneumonia back in January. I completely failed to diagnose it on myself. I wasn't bringing up green phlegm and I didn't have a high fever. And it was only when I went into hospital with sepsis, it didn't even show up on a chest x-ray. It only showed up on the CT scan. So pneumonia can be a tricky thing to pick up.
Absolutely. I suppose thinking about treatment for that, not for pneumonia, but for chest infections generally and for viral infections, I used to have three types of antibiotics. So depending on my assessment of the situation, I would use a must-have antibiotic. I'd talk to the patient about a may-have antibiotic or a shouldn't-have. So my three types of antibiotics were shouldn't-have, must-have, or may-have, which is sort of hedging your bets a little bit. But it's a way of trying to explain your management forwards depending upon your consideration of the diagnosis. So if I felt that somebody had definitely had a bacterial infection, then it would be a must-have. If I felt it was definitely a viral, then it would be a shouldn't have. And if I felt it was that they were robust and going to get better, then it would be a may have, and we can review in a couple of days. That's not very scientific, Peter.
I think that's perfectly valid, and it's empowering patients, isn't it? So you explain when to take those antibiotics. That seems totally appropriate to me, Andrew. So have we dealt with infections sufficiently? I mean, we haven't dealt with unusual things like TB and that sort of thing, but maybe that's a little bit small print.
I think it's a bit small print in Britain. It's certainly very important around the rest of the world. And they used to talk about consumption and wasting away and phthisis. And I'm not quite sure how you spell phthisis. But
lots of PHs, I think.
Lots of PHs, but there's certainly in some of the films about the Victorian or previous eras, I don't think it happens in Jane Austen, but the heroine or the hero will become weak and then cough up blood, and that's a sign of a TB cavitation causing major problems.
Yes, yes. And sadly, we're realizing that these infections that we all thought were in the past are still lurking there. And I think there's been a flare up of treatment resistant TB in New York a little while back, hasn't it? So it's not completely gone away by any means.
No. Thinking about asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, they're probably terms that a lot of people have heard about. Peter, what's the difference?
Right. So it's tricky. And again, they keep updating the asthma guidelines. I keep reading them, learning them. Then by the time it's got into my brain, they changed it and updated them. But so COPD, chronic bronchitis, as it used to be called, is very much a gradual shortness of breath, often triggered by smoking, sometimes by other dust and toxics. Toxins, but where you gradually become more short of breath over a long period of time. The thing about asthma is that it's very variable. And what's happening in the body is that the airways are becoming inflamed, whereas that's not a major part of COPD. And that inflammation then causes spasm of the airways. So you can relieve it with inhalers. The problem is that the inhalers that we like to use, which are steroid inhalers, patients don't. Because they don't get that instant effect that they do with something like salbutamol. They like to use the relievers, which are often called blue inhalers because they tend to be in blue containers. But they don't do anything about the underlying inflammation. And in fact, there's some evidence that just using those may actually irritate the airways and make asthma worse. And that's why in recent times, the guidelines have changed so that we now tend to use a combined inhaler so that people take it for the reliever but also get a bit of preventer almost inadvertently. That's a very, very brief and simple summary of a very complex area. Do you want to unpack it a bit more, Andrew?
I think that's very helpful, Peter. I don't know why it came into my mind, and maybe this is historical now, but mining in Britain, whether it's coal mining or other issues, were there particular issues there?
Yes. I mean, obviously, you get things like pneumoconiosis and of course, with asbestos, you can get lung disease as well. There is a bit of an overlap between asthma and COPD. where some people who have recurrent asthma seem to get long-standing chronic lung problems. So it's a little bit complex and muddy. But in general, if you think of asthma as being an acute onset wheeze and COPD as being more long-term shortness of breath, that's a good way to think of it.
Are there any particular triggers for asthma?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned anaphylaxis. And so those allergies to either things in the air or dietary things are very, very common and can be extremely serious, of course. You know, peanut allergies and things like that can be life-threatening, unfortunately. And exercise is a very, very common trigger for asthma. A lot of people get exercise-induced asthma. Again, you're probably more of an expert on this than me, aren't you, Andrew? You could probably rattle off a dozen allergies that trigger asthma in people, couldn't you?
I think that it varies hugely, but they can be, as you say, there can be quite a number, and peanuts is one, but there are lots of others. I think asthma is quite well known about, but what's also coming into my mind is issues such as alveolitis, which is where there's an inflammation in the lung substance, and how occupational dust can do that. We've heard, I think recently, how there's been a concern about people who are polishing stone. But over the years, there have been various issues with sawdust. And I think if you work with wood, if you're wood carving or wood turning in any way, there are some complicated regulations to ensure that you don't get to inhale that dust.
And from memory, the hardwood dusts, because they're finer, are much more of a risk than sawwood, softwood dust, from memory. And there's also a little bit of worry about these composite boards and the things they got in them and whether that might be harmful. But they haven't been around long enough for us to really know. And that's the problem, that these things, whether it's smoking or COPD or whatever, it can take 20 years before we know. We probably should cover asbestos as well, shouldn't we?
Which is a substance widely used for heat reduction and lagging and in brake pads for many years. But we now realise that it causes some pretty difficult and devastating problems for the lungs, Peter.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's asbestosis, which is similar to COPD in its effects. But there's also a specific cancer that asbestos can trigger, mesothelioma, which is pretty specific to asbestos. Even one fiber of asbestos can cause these problems. But having worked in Bristol, I used to have a number of patients who unloaded asbestos in Avonmouth docks, and they would talk about not being able to see their hands in front of their faces because the asbestos dust was so thick. And they would go home absolutely caked in asbestos. Okay. So they were getting incredibly high exposure to what at the time was thought to be a benign substance.
Yes. And the people they lived with would be getting passive exposure, of course, as well. Thinking about active and passive exposure, smoking is a big one. Smoking where we inhale smoke, either from cigars or cigarettes or other devices. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. Yeah, so if you smoke an average number of cigarettes, you've got about a 1 in 2, about a 50% chance of dying from that smoking. And of course, it's not just COPD and lung cancer. It's the effects on increasing the risk of heart attacks and strokes and all these other things as well.
Aging the body substantially and rapidly.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're a pipe smoker, you're also at risk of oral cancer. Famously, I think Sigmund Freud died of that, didn't he? So there's that local effect as well. So smoking, absolutely devastating.
How about vaping?
You preempted me. I was about to ask you the question in the hope that you would know about that. So my reading of the evidence is that vaping, it's as addictive as smoking because it's got the nicotine and that's what we're addicted to, but that it's less harmful to the lungs because it hasn't got the tar oils and things like that. it's early days, isn't it? It hasn't been around long enough to be absolutely sure, but that's my reading of the research so far. I don't know if you would agree with that, Andrew.
I think that would be a reasonable position at the moment, but we may well discover more problems than we realise from particularly the fragrances and others, or the tastes in them. These chemicals going straight into the lungs may have effects that we don't quite realise.
Absolutely, and I'd read the same thing about these plug-in scent that we all use around the house, that they may have damage. And there was also a paper fairly recently saying that that smoking cannabis, apart from obviously the effects of the cannabis and the risk from that, again, it's very much like cigarette smoke in that it puts your lungs at risk of COPD.
Yes. Thank you, Peter. That's very helpful. You mentioned hematological. Probably if anybody's got shortness of breath over a period of time, we would check a full blood count to see what their hemoglobin is. And it can be quite surprising sometimes.
It can. And you'd like to think, wouldn't you, that when somebody walks in, you see that they look pale. I've certainly missed it. And I've seen somebody who was actually asking me for a second opinion and said, oh, I was short of breath, and the GP arranged for an ECG. And I said, oh, well, did they look to see if you're anemic? And they said, no. And I said, well, you're not. Look, if you were, then when I pulled down your eyelid, you would look pale. And I did it. And sure enough, they were extremely pale. And when we checked their hemoglobin, it was 5.3. And they were admitted.
And 5.3. And a normal would be somewhere between 12 and 15. So that, I suppose, is somebody who, if they're short of breath or feeling faint, it's compensated over a period of time.
Yes, absolutely. And we're slightly digressing, but anemia is a really interesting problem because it can also present with psychiatric effects. So it can give you panic attacks, for instance, and anxiety because you're feeling shortness of breath. And we probably should mention, to be complete, about psychological effects. So things like panic attacks can make people feel extremely unwell with shortness of breath. And although it's benign, it's extremely scary. Do you want to say a bit about that, Andrew?
Yes. So the autonomic response to fight and flight puts us into sends lots of adrenaline around the system and puts us into a fear state. And we breathe more rapidly, shallowly, and through our upper chest. And that hyperventilation is starting us ready for action, but we can feel with that very anxious and very panicky, and we feel as though something dreadful is happening with our breathing.
Yes, absolutely, and it's something that it's important to make sure that there's no other cause for it before making this diagnosis. And I've certainly seen people who have recurrent pulmonary embolis that were diagnosed with panic attacks. So you need to be confident that you've ruled out the physical things before you make that diagnosis. But it's very reassuring for people who feel as though they're going to die to be able to say to them that, no, it's okay, you're just having a panic attack.
Especially when you can then very rapidly help them calm down. And I expect you, like I many years ago, saw an occasional patient who we thought were having a panic attack. And in that hyperventilation state, that rapid breathing, they had overbreathed and blown off their carbon dioxide to the point that it became a self-perpetuating cycle. And I can remember in minor injuries using a paper bag to help somebody rebreathe their own air, drop, raise their own carbon dioxide, and actually recover in front of me to the point where I could say, well, please now just take control of your breathing and just let's slow it down and see how it feels. And that person regained their state of mind and their calmness, partly with the help of the advice, but also because of the paper bag.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, if somebody is doing that and overbreathing, they can become acidotic and they can then get pins and needles in their hands and all sorts of other strange symptoms as well, which makes it even more scary. So a
couple of very rare things. So you mentioned acidotic. So if you're in diabetic ketoacidosis, you actually be breathing quite deeply and rapidly and feel short of breath.
Crismal breathing.
Rarely overactive thyroid could make you feel like that. But I think an untreated overactive thyroid would be very rare to see these days. And then, of course, carbon monoxide poisoning is around.
Mm.
I think everybody would be advised, if they've got an open fire or a wood burner, to have a carbon monoxide monitor. I think current advice, whether it's fire service or government or others, is that if you've got a gas boiler, it's worth having a carbon monoxide detector to just make sure that that's not a cause of a problem in your home. And then we have things like aspirin overdose would be quite rare. But any particular medications could make your breathing worse, Peter, that could make your asthma worse or your COPD?
Well, the classic thing with asthma is beta blockers, isn't it? Which absolutely will absolutely worsen it and, you know, potentially extremely seriously. Is that what you had in mind, Andrew?
I can remember being a houseman and my consultant had seen a patient privately with anxiety, prescribed a beta blocker, and that person was admitted by me on take the next day.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, we haven't been, in preparation for this, I went through asking various authorities and looking online and so on, and it came up with several dozen possible differential diagnoses, which it wouldn't be productive or useful to cover. But I hope we've given people the idea that shortness of breath is quite a complex area. And I would want to leave them with the message that, particularly if it's new, sudden and severe, they should seek medical attention urgently. And if they've got chest pain with it, or it's extremely severe, they should probably even bypass the GP and dial 999. What messages would you leave people with, Andrew?
I would absolutely endorse that. And if you're eating, whether it's out or in, make sure somebody around you knows the Heimlich manoeuvre. There's a great thing about everybody learning to do CPR now. There's a cardiopulmonary resuscitation, but Heimlich manoeuvre, I'm sure it was life saving at that dinner I was at a couple of years ago, unbeknownst to many of us who were in the room.
Yes. And while we've been chatting, David has posted that it was indeed a nursing home, but that it was actually Dr. Heimlich himself who saved one of the other residents rather than the other way around. So thank you for clarifying that. What I wasn't sure was an urban myth, David, but you say it comes from the BBC, so it must be true.
Peter, that's a great exploration of shortness of breath. Thank you very much indeed for that. And thank you, everyone, for listening, and go well.
Thank you all.